Welcome to Sustainable Voices. I'm your host, Thomas Walsh. Seeds for Change, Creatively Confronting the Energy Crisis, Part 2. The following presentation was recorded at the opening night of the Sustainable Living Festival. Held once a year in Melbourne, Victoria, the festival showcases various environmentally sound technologies, hosts numerous talks and discussions, and gives us the opportunity to come together and celebrate the joy of a sustainable lifestyle. Published in 1978, Seeds for Change was a book that described the energy crisis and its implications for Victoria and Australia many years before it entered the awareness of the general public. In fact, it has only been in the last 12 months or so that we have really started to see the idea of peak oil being discussed in mainstream media. The book offered a vision for Melbourne based on the idea of cluster and connect, that we cluster our communities with our places of employment and our other activities in order to creatively respond to the increasing scarcity of cheap energy. In this presentation, the authors of the book, Seeds for Change, came together 27 years after the publication of the influential book for a retrospective on the 25 years that have passed since the book's publication. After discussing the development of the book in the first half of this presentation, the authors now discuss how far we have come, what relevance the book still has, what has already happened, and what remains to be done. John Dix of the Energy Action Group talks about what has happened in the last 30 years and where we are now.
I was going to sit down and talk from the chair, but Deborah actually made a fairly fundamental point. It's about institutions and institutional structures. Because I've spent the last 25 years in the area of economics and finance, and I'm one of the few people here who actually has anything to do with the national electricity market and the national gas markets. And what is worthwhile doing, Chris and I probably had the fetish on the first third of the book that there was a forthcoming crisis, particularly after Chris has defined his experience in Japan. But I think it's worthwhile looking at what happened in the last 30 years since this book has been published. The Australian population has gone from 11 million to 20 million, so it's almost doubled. Primary and secondary energy consumption in Victoria has doubled. So what we've got institutional forces building a society, and per capita consumption is going up. The financial institutions know how to spend money. The projects are very identifiable. They're large, they're complex, and they basically are dominating the status quo. And it's not unusual, if you looked at the point where Deborah was having some difficulty with the privatisation of the State Electricity Commission, the amount of money that's going in currently to just duplicate and look at load growth within the national electricity market. The jurisdictional regulators have approved some $9,000 million to be spent in the next 4 years. That's almost four times the amount being spent on renewable energy of any form, any shape. That's if renewable energy is actually appropriate to the way this market consumes energy. And if we start looking at the institutional structures, it's worthwhile looking at the seeds. Ian made some comments earlier on that the observation I've passed is that the seeds are currently there, but they're on rocky ground and they certainly haven't been watered. Alan made mention of the $1 million of the Australian assistance schemes that the Whitlam government had in place, where community groups were being lubricated. We have a substitution currently. Community childcare is subservient to ABC Learning, which is now a multi-billion dollar enterprise. Community health funds and community health groups are basically being subverted to the user pay process. So what's actually happening is that there are some seeds out there, but in essence, the major functions of the society are dominated by politicians spending on pet projects, and most of it's to maintain the status quo. The status quo is increased consumption. And as someone who is playing in the national electricity market, all the institutional arrangements, the rules, the codes, the market itself, all reward load growth. And it doesn't have to be rational load growth. It's not unfair to say that that $9 billion that's going to be spent on increasing networks will be spent for somewhere in the order of 5 to 10 days of the year to meet summer peaking, mainly air conditioning loads. So the reality is there is a challenge. We have some technology. Things like computers and everything else have improved the ability to model. But the challenge for you and for this group is to actually come up with some answers. And the beauty of the way that the Crows actually operated, because I was the spoilt one of the group, I used to stay there. And so I had around about 24 hours every week of Ruth and Murray. And I've survived. But the important part of that is that it's about relationships, it's about developing some sense of what's going on, what's possible. At the same time, you need to be thoroughly aware of the institutions that are in place. And one of the great things that, it's the most horrifying thing that's actually happened is the internationalisation of finance. It allows very large sums of money to flow for speculation. And it is not difficult for any project financier to find the billions of dollars to do the project, whether it be coal tar sands, whether it be deep sea oil drilling or a whole range of other things. Those are the institutional forces. And Ian basically made mention of a conference that he went to this morning in terms of the big end of town. I work with the big end of town constantly, and they are still to be convinced. They're the ones with the access to the billions. They're the ones building the projects. We're the ones who are on the receiving end of that. What we've got to do is find some strategies that allow us to make a major transition, recognising that the techno-optimists and the people who are running things like natural capitalism and everything else haven't quite understood that the major financial sources are dominating what's happening. And the net effect of it is we've got to come up with strategies that actually allow a major transition. We will not change 600 million cars worldwide tomorrow. It will take time. We can't change the whole lot of institutional consumption patterns around Melbourne based on the car. We've got to find ways of actually working that through. Seeds for Change actually was working on a 30-year planning cycle. That was 30 years ago. What I've said to you is that we've doubled our consumption in that period of time, so we've all got this slightly bigger addiction, and you can see it in my waistline. And the net effect of all of this is the challenge for all of us is how do we go forward, how do we find meaningful, workable solutions, because the planet clearly has changed and will continue to change. That's how we actually make the planet viable.
Philip Sutton, the President of the Sustainable Living Foundation, returns to talk about the direction we need to take from here and explores the continued relevance of the book.
Where does that lead us now? I mean, I think the reason why it's worth dusting off, literally dusting off the book and pulling it out again, is because many of the issues that we dealt with then are almost a carbon copy of what we're faced with now. People are getting very excited about discovering Hubbard's bubble, you know, the peak oil issue. Well, Chris wrote about it, introduced us to it in detail when we were working on the book. And so we've, in a sense, been living with this as a concept. I think the shock for us is that we're still alive to see the bloody thing happen. You know what I mean? Like, I always thought it was going to happen sometime in somebody else's generation. Does that make sense? I mean, you talk about, we have to do this for some, you know, for our grandchildren. Well, you know, heaven help us, we're still here, and the issues are biting, the greenhouse issues biting, and the peak oil issues biting. So what do we do about it? Is the vision that we developed then enough? I think it's a fantastic vision that we should try and implement a vast amount of. But I also have found in the last few years that something's changed my attitudes towards how we should go. I actually think that in some respects, Seeds for Change is actually not radical enough. It was talking about creating a city in which cars didn't dominate. That seems pretty radical. But the thing was that we were very much emphasising the importance of public transport. So you could still have quite a dispersed city. I think with the new information coming through on the scale of change we need in order to achieve sustainability. Things like this, the Dutch Sustainable Technology Development Program, where they've identified that you need something like a...
Well, could you just say that again? What's it called?
It's Sustainable Technology Development. It's a Dutch program, and there's a book with that title, Sustainable Technology Development, and it's the lead author, but was Paul Weaver, and the program leader was Leo Janssen. Leo Janssen's from the Netherlands. Anyway, they scoped out the size of the problem. How much we'd have to improve eco efficiency to achieve sustainability now. This is current. This is year 2000. They were saying we need a factor 20 to factor 50 improvement in efficiency. When you get rid of the factor jargon and put it into percentage improvement terms, that's a 95 to 98% improvement in resource use efficiency, i.e. using 95 to 98% less resources for anything we produce. Now, that's really what we have to do. And what's interesting is that the Seeds for Change ideas, I think, are a really important part of that, but I think we have to go further as well. So there's some fantastic ideas developed by a guy called Richard Register, who's written a book called Eco Cities. And he is emphasising the pedestrian city. We were talking very much about the public transport city or the bike city. We certainly recognised the importance of pedestrianisation, but it was an adjunct. Whereas I think that Richard Register, if you combine the insights of the Dutch approach with Richard's work, you start to get an idea of some of the really substantial changes we need to make. And the other thing is my feeling about the speed of change. John was saying that we were thinking about... We took a pragmatic view in those days where cities, buildings, power stations, they turn over. Some things last for a few years, some things last longer. Power station might last 30 or 50 years. The physical layout of a city might last hundreds in terms of street structure and so on. But my own personal view now is that we've had 40 years of talking about what we need to do, and we've been fairly active in the 30 of those years of talking. And I think that the next 10 years have to be the 10 years in which we physically and socially do what needs to be done. That we simply cannot afford another period of time that we've spent talking and planning and so on. We actually physically have to change and socially change the way we organise our city. And I'm now thinking, why don't we think in terms of 10 years? It's a period of time that we can relate to because it's not somebody else's problem. 30 years is somebody else's problem. 10 years, it's pretty clear it's our problem.
Deborah White returns to talk about what we can do to help and what is already happening.
I travel by bicycle and I have a much less... apart from flying overseas, I have to admit that. So while I'm living in Adelaide, I use significantly less water, less energy than I ever did before. So there are things we can all do, and it's our responsibility. If everybody stopped drinking Coca-Cola, if everybody stopped eating McDonald's, if everybody stopped having air conditioning, the companies that depend on you buying all that stuff would go broke. It isn't hard. So at least we can do that, and our friends can do that, and our kids can do that, and our mothers and fathers even. I mean, if my father became a greenie, anything can happen. So that's one thing. It seems to me that, for instance, when I first went to Adelaide, we had a couple of blackouts, electrical blackouts. We had nothing to do with privatisation. They had to do with everyone turning the heaters on a cold winter morning. However, 15 years ago, we had the first blackout because everybody turned their air conditioners on a hot summer afternoon. Now, you don't need to do that if you're sensible about your house. Anyone who turns an air conditioner on a hot summer afternoon is destroying the planet needlessly, and they're not being frugal, and they're not being properly hedonistic. I just every now and then pray that they'll all get Legionnaire's disease, quite honestly, but that's possibly not the sort of thing I'm supposed to say. I have never lived in an air-conditioned house. I have no intention of ever doing so, and I live much more happily. So that was the bit which wasn't answering Winsome's question. Now, Winsome, what was your question? I really will answer it.
You're a wild lot. I guess what I'm trying to take this part of the discussion is to say, what are the things that are in Seeds for Change that are as relevant today as they ever were that we could be doing, and you've talked about your house bit. Are there other principles there that we can I guess we've got two roles, haven't we? We've got to try and do something ourselves, and we've also got to understand and analyse, as John Dick says, what the situation is and try and bring pressure to bear on those who are making the decisions. I mean, I've had five developments happening around my house in North Melbourne, and I'm sort of quite supportive because it's all about strong centred cities and having concentrations of people living near public transport nodes. But as I've watched them go up, they've all had plate glass windows facing north with no shade on it. Now, I mean, it's can we change the local planning laws to bring about the sort of requirements that that mean that people have to do these sorts of things rather than then put in noisy air conditioners, etc. And what are the practical things that we can learn and we can advocate for as well as do ourselves?
I've now remembered the question. You asked if there were places where these things, sorts of things are happening, and in fact in Adelaide there is one. It's called Christie Walk, and it is a little pedestrian city, or pedestrian bit. It's a fractal of the city. It's within walking distance of anything you might like to get to in Adelaide, the festival, the centre of the town. You'd have to get a bike, I think, to get to the sea. But it's very highly dense, but it grows its own food, it keeps its own water, it cleans its own sewage. It's built on what used to be an industrial site in the inner square section of Adelaide. The houses are built of straw bale and Hebel blocks, autoclave concrete blocks. So there are things happening, but as John said, the institutional blockages to doing that were absolutely enormous, and it's only that the people involved in it are absolutely determined. So it seems to me that getting together and being determined and not being deviated by the fact that a lot of the things that we want to do which are environmentally sensible are actually illegal. Maybe I shouldn't be saying that sort of thing. Things do change. In my city council, the council area where I live in Adelaide, when I built my house, I said I would not send any of the rainwater into the street channel. I would keep it all on the land because it seems to me that building a house should not change the hydrological balance. And they stopped the work on the house and told me I couldn't build it and got very angry with me. And I got angry with them back. Eventually, I persuaded them and I had to write a disclaimer that I would compensate any neighbours who got flooded from the water on my roof and that sort of thing. 20 years later, they now actually require you to show why you can't keep the water on your land, and it's almost illegal to put it into the street channel. Now, that was just by being bloody-minded, because a house I did a year after my own house, I saw that we were going to have to keep all the water on the site because it sloped away from the road, and to pump it up to the street would have been crazy. So I went into the council straight away and said, remember me? And that day I got the permit. So even institutions have got people in them, and if we are stronger than them and if we are more right than them, we can do something.
Dr. Ian MacPhail, Victorian Minister for Environmental Sustainability, returns to conclude the presentation.
Let me say, sometimes I wonder whether my job is to skillfully manage the slow degradation of the environment, and whether, in fact, we're trying to play around the edges of the problem without ever really getting through to the centre of it. And even though Philip took some considerable time to say it, I think it was still accurate that, in fact, our task is really how to mobilise so that we can become part of the juggernaut and have it going in the direction that we need. Not that it is the enemy, but how we become the part of it and how we then slowly begin to change the direction. I think that's very important. I couldn't help but reflect upon the electricity from coal debate that John has spoken about so passionately. I do think we need to take a very deep breath. The problem is, well, not the problem, one of the great things is we won't get nuclear in Australia because it's too darn expensive compared with electricity from coal. For starters, we have the cheapest electricity in the developed world because we have the most abundant coal resources. If there hadn't been anything like a greenhouse effect, we wouldn't even be talking about it. We might be talking about the rationality of spending $9 billion on peak loads, but that's a different argument. The fact is, we can generate all the electricity we need from coal cheaply. Consequently, how do we change the debate? How do we get the debate changed around coal-fired generation because of its massive global impacts? I was also taken by some of the comments that Deborah made. I do remember Deborah. I was Director General of the Department of Environment and Planning in South Australia, and I realise now that I got a couple of dear fool letters from her. You know, if you only had a brain somewhere between that space between your ears, you would understand that. And then a couple of times we did get into the same room together, and she seemed today, tonight, to be such a superbly human person, but to me she was thoroughly Olympian and quite strict in her comments. But I do realise that it was in Adelaide. I was one of those who pushed for the reintroduction of rainwater tanks. It was stopped by the health department because of all of those historic problems of water quality in badly maintained water tanks that were the primary water supply for houses. I know, there are always people like you. That's why we have rules. So let me... which means then, and we can finally decide when to get you too, by the way. But if I can just come back just very quickly to it, just a couple of final points. Firstly, I think it is fair to say that more seeds have germinated than we realise. I think also that there is an emerging, even if it is an inchoate acceptance amongst the general community, that there is a resource issue, even if at the moment it is still not sufficiently developed for the individual to believe they have to be part of turning it around. Lastly, can I say that when Mother Teresa was asked by someone, you are confronted with so many massive problems, how do you cope with it? How can you cope with it? And a response was, one person at a time. I think we each have a very clear individual responsibility to start with ourselves while we're mobilising to attack the juggernaut, to go for the institutions. But John is very correct. The juggernaut is there, and the juggernaut is for the turning, if I can misuse scripture. Lastly, let me say, and I can say it because Winston is acting as the MC, but she's actually part of the group. What an extraordinarily fine group of people. So not... Yeah. Not only did they put together a book which now appears to be entirely prescient and highly relevant, except for that problem that was identified, the 40-year time lag, which is the problem. If many of those actions had been taken, started 40 years ago, they would require less urgency and there'd be a lesser crisis in which to cope with them. But the other thing that I am astonished, I know of no other group of people who could have met once a week for 3 years and actually not have led to divorce, blood, mayhem and a total disaster, or maybe it did. But anyway, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Dr. McPhail.
To find out more about this show, to join the discussions on the forum or to receive updates on upcoming shows, go to sv.baximus.com. Thanks for listening.